you only get the policy mix right, we're gonna arrive at some sort of equilibrium in the market. All of this conversation is not only highly inaccurate from a purely research perspective, because you can take a lot of this piece into pieces and from both a theoretical and from a data and from an analytical perspective. But most importantly, it depoliticizes houses. Time and again, we put in place policies that are deliberately making housing profitable, that ensure high returns on investment. And then I get on the radio at 7 o'clock in the morning before having enough caffeine, and people ask me, how come it's unaffordable? I was like, why is
You know, it's easy to say, I'll just be like us, just be like the point. But at the end of the day, what we're gonna really need in this country is a program that invests a massive amount of funds into the construction of new social housing units, but more importantly, the ability for the provincial, the federal, or even the municipal government to rip away private housing from private landlords, right? If you're a landlord and you have six buildings, right? And you run them like you're a baron, and you harass tenants, you bring them to court, you make their lives a living hell. The federal government, which is paid by our taxpayer dollars, which is mandated to help us as working class people, should be allowed to go and rip that unit away from them and socialize that building. What we need right now, and this you'll see every social housing group, every tenants' rights group agree on this, we need to be able to remove private housing stock and socialize it en masse. It's the only way we can do it. We can't wait 10 years to build six giant high-rises. We need right now a machine that can socialize buildings en masse and give them back to the tenants. That's the only way forward.
But protesters are clear that whether or not Bill 31 goes through, the public opposition that the bill has garnered since last June will not slow down. Tenants have suffered enough, they say, under a housing crisis, and they won't stop pushing the government for stronger measures and protections.
The bill has crystallized something. So, whether this bill is passed or not, I think it's just the beginning of the anger and the indignation being expressed by tenants. So, there will be more, of course. We won't back down as an organization, of course, unless we have proper rent control, unless we have proper social housing financing. I think it's just the beginning of something much bigger than just the opposition against Bill 31.
PL 31 will go through, it will pass. They're a majority party. But I think what's going to happen is they're going to face a wave of contestation of which they haven't seen yet, and we haven't seen yet since the 60s in this province.
CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
A weekly radio program from WFHB that focuses on issues in the prison system and beyond.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these words across the prison walls.
This week, we focus on two people who are studies in dignity in the face of state repression. Jack Mazurek was arrested in Atlanta yesterday and charged with arson, allegations stemming from an attack on police motorcycles tied to the movement against Cop City. He's standing strong despite the serious charges against him as people around the country mobilize in his defense. Leon Benson, who we'll hear from later on in the episode, survived decades in Indiana prisons, organizing against the guards and admins despite terrifying repression, and emerged unbroken and exonerated a year ago. This is the second part of our most recent conversation with Leon. As for Jack, on Thursday morning, law enforcement officers from a joint task force that included the Atlanta Police Department, FBI, GBI, an ATF, executed one arrest warrant and three search warrants on two homes in the Lakewood Heights area and one in the Starlight Heights neighborhood that police say are associated with the Stop Cop City movement. At a press conference, the Atlanta police chief said the search warrants were for evidence related to a series of arson and vandalism attacks that took place over the last few months. The arrest warrant was for an arson against police motorcycles that took place in July at an APD facility at 180 Southside Industrial Parkway. And the police chief also said he anticipated additional arrests related to the acts of arson in the coming weeks. A second individual was taken from one of the three homes and detained for several hours at police headquarters. The Atlanta Community Press Collective obtained a copy of one of the search warrants, which were issued by a magistrate judge in the United States District Court of North Georgia. Collected evidence included laptops, cell phones, memory cards, a modem, and stickers, a flyer, and a poster for Defend the Atlanta Forest. The search warrant alleged violation of federal statutes on destruction of motor vehicles or motor vehicle facilities, a conspiracy to commit offense or to defraud the United States, solicitation to commit a crime of violence, transfer of explosives, knowing or believing it will be used to commit a crime of violence, interstate domestic violence, and interstate and foreign travel or transportation in aid of racketeering enterprises. Police did not announce any charges related to these statutes. A media contact from within the movement against Cop City stated, quote, "These raids are an escalation at the federal level and an attack on the movement to disappear dissenters against Cop City," unquote. Residents of one of the houses searched by police say the FBI busted down a side door and called for everyone to come outside, where they were put into flex cuffs, placed into police vehicles, and eventually photographed by GBI agents. All residents and guests of the home were allowed to leave on their own power. A press release sent out by representatives of the Stop Cop City movement said that one officer found a nude photograph of a resident of another house, which was then displayed to other officers. Another individual who was not arrested reported that police dragged them by their hair while executing the search warrant. Representatives from the Atlanta Solidarity Fund told press they plan to post bail for Mazurek when possible. Activists held a press conference at 5 p.m. on Thursday at 191 Peachtree Street, where the Atlanta Police Foundation is headquartered. The APF is the nonprofit entity the city is using to build the Atlanta Public Safety Training Center, called Cop City, by opponents. Many of the acts of arson that occurred over the last few months were directed at companies contracted to construct the training center, which is the subject of a multi-year protest movement. The arsons are just one of the tools amongst a diversity of tactics used by opponents of the training center. Since 2021, activists have provided dozens of hours of public comment in front of the Atlanta City Council, held teach-ins and learning sessions, and engaged in acts of civil disobedience. The Stop Cop City Vote Coalition said that it collected over 116,000 signatures on a petition for a referendum question that would allow voters to decide the fate of the facility. Despite turning in the referendum signatures in September, the city has yet to begin the process of validating those signatures and has spent over $1.2 million in legal fees fighting the referendum and other legal challenges in federal courts. We'll continue to update you on Mazurek's situation as it unfolds. And now we return to our conversation with the recently exonerated Leon Benson. He talks about the surreal feeling of being arrested for a crime he didn't commit, and the government's frequent use of criminal informants to target people like him.
At the time, before we came in, I was drinking some Remy, and I had like several blunts, and I was kind of toasted, so I fell asleep. I did remember that I broke my pager because I didn't want my pager going off while I was in there, and they potentially could trace some of my dealings. And I was awakened, like, I don't know how long from when I was in a stupor, but I was awakened by a homicide detective by the name of Alan Jones. And he said that I'm a suspect in a murder. Like, this was laughable to me. I was, oh my God, like, stop. He said, "These people said they seen you do it." I'm like, oh, they bull crap, and this is bullshit. And I thought that they were trying to angle at me for my drug activity because I never sold drugs on a corner. I always did it behind closed doors. I'm thinking, like, if y'all got some marked money, I'm like, say something, like, what's going on? Y'all talking about a murder. Y'all playing, you know. So a bad move on my part, I gave the detective's statement, because I was being honest. I was like, what I got to lose? I was innocent. I was in the little Vietnam, but I couldn't be Pacific because I never thought like this stuff would come back. So I was like, I was in the back of the building, and I did omit that I was selling drugs, but who cares if I was selling drugs? I didn't murder nobody. This was my thinking. So I told them where I was at. I named names and I named apartment numbers of people that seen me. I was in this place literally like for hours all through the day. But what I didn't factor in that people in the residence probably was like, I'm not talking to the police because it endangered me. I don't know what to say, this and that. So they just like, I didn't see him. He wasn't there. Or the detective just plain didn't interview certain people. Long story short, in that particular interrogation at the end, he placed me under arrest for murder. And I laughed at him. I'm like, man, stop, man. Come on, man. And then the detective, in a very hostile way, had his officer strip me of my street clothes, which is something that's unprecedented. This is 7 days later from the crime. I had some brand new Air Max 96s on with the bubble at the bottom, you know, and I had some Pelly Pale pants on, jogging pants at the time. And he took me out of these things and dressed me in an orange jumpsuit, you know, really like, you know, against my will. And it really pissed me off. And he left me to walk through the county jail for weeks because I had to wait in a holding session before I went to the actual county jail where I'd be held for trial. So I was like in the county jail for like 2 weeks with no shoes, no flip flops, nothing. He did this on purpose to humiliate me. So my response was, to him, I was like, man, you know, man, your mama gonna be sorry, man. You do me like this. You know, I was just young and stupid and I was angry. This is what I said. And I say this to say, I don't know if that was part of the reason why these things started to set in place. So one thing I want to tell your listeners, for me, it's two things here. You know, Indianapolis was historically, you know, a white ran city, a upper class, upper middle class, you know, white city. It didn't have no particular history of struggle like a lot of the other cities, these black belt communities, these rust belt communities, pardon me, rust belt communities are communities that were made out of the vacuum of major factories like GM or some major manufacturer in the city, and they took flight from that particular city, and it made a void of crime, of unemployment, of this thing because they left. Hence, you know, it created a pool for people to be fed into the prison industrial complex. So this is a big part of mass incarceration. So the thing about Indianapolis at the time, it didn't have that thing. Detroit represented something different to somebody like Alan Jones, who was an older guy at the time, an older homicide detective. At that time, he had been on the force in 1998 for 27 years. So I'm not saying that Detective Jones is outright racist, but from my case and from how I was treated, I can honestly and fairly say he suffered from implicit bias, at least, you know, at least, you know. So with me donning the nickname Detroit, I didn't know that it came with, in my observation, unforgivable blackness. So first, you already know the Great Migration in the early 20th century of black sharecroppers from the South going into Detroit and these Chicago areas, you know, to set up shop. And at that time, Detroit was like the hub for black excellence. And, you know, it was frowned upon by, you know, races, you know, white people at that time. And you know, it was a whole different feel to be black. It was empowering to be black. And, you know, the Rust Belt community part that really was made in Detroit and Flint as well was the white flight of GM. You know, this occurred during the 1967. And it was because of police brutality. You know, the city went up. They got to burning down these businesses. So white flight took place, you know, namely a lot of the factory jobs and things like that. That left a void. And it allowed other, you know, communities to come in place to fill that void, you know, the best way they could. And most of that void got filled through crime, things like that. So it really helped proliferate, you know, mass incarceration in Michigan. You know, Michigan got like, you know, like 50,000, you know, inmates today, and over like 40 prisons here in the state of Michigan, you know, all over. You know, it's one of the highest volume of incarceration in the states, in the United States. So I didn't know all these things was going on. And I felt like because the victim was white, it was a moral panic that took place. A thing that we need to understand statistically, cross-race crime is low, meaning black on white or white on Latin or Latin on black. That's a scarcity, you know, in criminology statistically. So when you got a white victim and a so-called black perpetrator, it becomes more of a moral panic, you know, the politicians, to the police, things like that. The implicit bias start, you know, this Salem witch hunt mentality or the Inquisition mentality, you know, starts to take place by these officials. And it makes it more ripe for official misconduct in this capacity. And I believe that this is what set the tone, you know, for me, even though it was a lot of evidence, overwhelming evidence pointing at somebody else. But to add to the eyewitnesses, the so-called eyewitnesses, Donald Brooks, he give a statement August 15th, a day after that I gave a statement that I was in Little Vietnam. And he make the statement that, hey, it was me and another gentleman and other people standing out on the corner tonight by the victim's truck. And he laid down. He was in the window of the St. Regis apartment. And he laid down. He seen me. Then he heard shots. Then he got up and he claimed he seen me walking east across the street of Pennsylvania going towards the Little Vietnam building. Now, what's odd is there was an eyewitness by the name of Christy Smith. She was a white woman. She was a Star News delivery woman. And she was servicing her newspaper vending box, which happened to be 147 feet away from the end of Shane's truck, the victim's truck. And she said that she was in the middle of loading her newspapers and she heard gunshots, and she looked up, you know, to her left, and she seen a individual wearing all black with jogging pants with white stripes, like some Adidas pants, and walking, just clearing the gate of the truck of the victim, and then turn back around and shoot two more times in the cab of the truck, and then take off running through the Damien Center parking lot on Pennsylvania, which is like at best 15 feet away from the truck going to the right side, going west. And that's what she said she seen. And she got in her car, tried to call 911. She couldn't get through, where her van rather, she was parked close to the vending machine, which made sense because she was loading the vending machine. Then she got in her van and she drove past, driving south. Pennsylvania is a one way south, you know, in Indianapolis. So she drove south, passing the victim's truck, passing a parking lot where she initially said that she's seen a lot of individuals in the parking lot. She passed that, finally got to the 911 dispatch, came back and, you know, waited for police. It was another woman there by the name of Shirley King who came out the St. Regis building, and they waited on the police to arrive. And, you know, they found Casey Shane slumped in his truck. And she gave the police a statement, and she said that the person she seen, you know, had black t-shirt, black jogging pants with white stripes, dark shoes, had no facial hair, that he was dark-skinned. He was a dark-skinned, you know, African-American male. And, you know, that was, you know, the premise of my arrest, as well as the premise of my overall eventual wrongful incarceration.
Because of these issues, both the panic and the implicit bias and, you know, dynamics in Indy, it seems like the authorities were eager to overlook someone that I read in that University of Michigan article was eventually a paid informant. And so I was wondering if you could talk about Joseph Webster and the sort of circumstances of how you got focused on and not someone who ended up working for the police.
Oh yeah, that's, you know, for me, I want to say this, you know, my trials, you know, I went to trial. I had two trials. It was a hung jury the first time because the mere mention of another eyewitness in the case by the name of Dakari Fulton, who said they seen the individual that you just spoke of commit the crime. And the second trial, it went awry, it was a runaway, a landslide for the state, because my attorney Timothy Miller, he was, you know, he done what he could do, but the state overwhelmed everything. We didn't find Dakari Fulton, even though he was in the custody of the state the whole time, but nobody could find him. He was in the custody of the state at Riverside Work Release, ironically, right down the street from the crime. So all these things happened. I believe because of what I explained earlier, the Detroit connection, the outsider connection, they would feel like I had more a vindictive vein to do something to somebody in the white community. I'm speculating because it was overwhelming evidence to this other suspect, the one that you mentioned, and overwhelming. And this person is suspected to be an informant as early as the 90s and doing a part of this case. He was a CI on some things he suspected, but later on in the case, it was found out that, you know, he had become a confidential informant in 2017, specifically on a huge high profile case in Indianapolis, Indiana, you know, against Ricky Grundy, AKA the Grundy Gang. You know, and this guy got caught, the informant in here got caught with a whole bunch of drugs and flipped. And he was in a operation, the federal government called Operation Electric Avenue. You hear me? Big informant. You know, it makes me think about the Fred Hampton situation, but and by no means am I comparing myself to Fred Hampton and all the great work that the Honorable Fred Hampton done, you know, in the Chicago chapter of the Black Panthers. In no way am I doing that because I was lost. However, we do know that a lot of the so-called drug dealers and leaders of the community, we were already up under COINTELPRO. So the drugs in the community, they didn't come. I didn't bring no drugs in the community. Somebody else did to try to subdue the rise of the next Black Messiah, as J. Edgar Hoover, you know, the director of the FBI at the time of the 60s and 70s. You know, this COINTELPRO or counterintelligence program, it had been implemented. I had been a victim of it. So I'm not comparing myself to Fred Hampton and all the great stuff that that young brother was doing, you know, in his time, because he was helping out the people. He was bringing together gangs and stuff like that. However, it was a person that was an agent provocateur named William O'Neill. William O'Neill, he acted like he was a Panther, and, you know, he infiltrated the Panthers, and he was instrumental. He got caught with something, and he was a confidential informant, you know, as well. And he set Fred Hampton up to be murdered. You know, thank the universe, you know, thank, you know, the Most High that, you know, at least, you know, his son, Fred Hampton Jr. survived. But it was very tragic. And I liken this situation of how confidential informants are used. For me, like, what is it? I still ask myself, why me? Why me? Why Leon Benson, though? Why me? Me personally, I feel like the drug dealers, the people in the community of this stature, the lumping proletariat is a big pulse to this system. If the drug dealer, it's a movie that's out called Cloning Tyrone. And I implore, you know, everybody to watch it, because you got people who are being cloned in a movie, you know, played by, you know, Jamie Foxx starring in a movie, and several other, you know, A-list actors. But in this movie, it's four people who are being cloned repeatedly. The prostitute, the pimp, the drug dealer, and the hitter, the violent guy. So when you see these four archetypes of this community, imagine if these people say, you know what? I'm not going to do that no more. I'm going to do something else to help the community. Because these four individual archetypes has the most influence on that part of urban America. And it's been proven that it's counterintelligence programs that are enticing this behavior more than, hey, you need to go to college, more than, hey, won't you take your influence and lead your people somewhere? Won't you be a politician? Oh, instead of you being the guy that's going around knocking people off and doing it, why won't you protect your community? Won't you be like a Panther, you know, and protect your community and serve your community that way? Why won't you be a mother and bring that nurturing to your community this other way? So I say to this effect, when we talk about the real killer in this case, they have afforded immunity, right? The Indianapolis police, Alan Jones, he had another confidential informant who had told a narcotics agent back in the 90s that he was with this gentleman that committed the crime and everything. He was with him, seeing it, and he wrote a letter to the officer, and Detective Jones had this the whole time. He had it the whole time. But that's why I suspect that the real killer was a confidential informant back then, as he is now. He was being protected all the way through. And when you work in for him, like Bill O'Neill, right, you get immunity from things. Long as you're doing the work, you know, for the agency, just like Sammy the Bull. Sammy the Bull was the biggest rat ever. But, you know, he got bodies on bodies. But the government, they give him immunity. Cause he tell on John Gotti. What's the justice in that? What is that telling society and telling people? That ain't right. So in this situation, it happened again with the true killer in this case, Big Rat. I feel very angry for that, you know, that fact, you know, for somebody that turned into an agent provocateur. And in the context I want to give you guys is, in America, when we talking about snitching, America got treason. That's snitching. That means you snitched. You switched to the other side. You told on your family in a place where you said, hey, this is the people I'm with. So the American government, the United States of American government, treason is punishable by death. So what I'm saying is, you know, people who partake in the street life, I mean, you want to partake in the street life, you want to sell drugs, you want to kill people, but when the heat come down on you, now you want to change and you want to be an agent. And the sad part is the government, the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigations, they allow you to do it. So in this sense, I feel like I'm nowhere comparing myself to Fred Hampton for what he did. But I am saying me, as well as many of poor people and people of color, has the potential to rise up and lead our own community and don't need no interference from undermining government capitalist agendas.
This has been KiteLine. Thank you to everyone who contributed to the show. You can follow KiteLine Radio on all social media platforms. And if you want to financially support our work, you can become a supporter at patreon.com/KiteLine Radio. Any funds raised beyond operating costs will be sent to folks on the inside. Please check out our new searchable website with hundreds of archived shows at kitelineradio.org. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. KiteLine, WFHB, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the opinions expressed on the show. Thank you for listening. Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program from WFHB that focuses on issues in the prison system and beyond.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these words across the prison walls.
We start off this episode with our monthly roundup of prison disturbances as compiled by Perilous Chronicle.
On October 4th, four prisoners held captive at the Troup County Jail in LaGrange, Georgia, set fire to a pile of prisoner uniforms in response to prison staff revoking television access. The prisoners were denied access to television as a punishment for an unknown violation. According to jail staff, the prisoners were able to dismantle a light fixture and then use the live wires to set the clothes on fire. Once smoke was detected, the unit was evacuated. All four prisoners are being charged with riot, and two of the prisoners have additional charges, including arson.
Five prisoners at the Tecumseh State Prison in Nebraska intentionally set fires in their cells on October 5th, refusing orders to comply with guards. After a so-called emergency response team was brought in, four prisoners were extracted from their cells, and one, 27-year-old Jesse Spencer, was found dead. Local media did not report on the motivation for the protest, nor on the cause of Spencer's death.
Nine people detained at the Charles B. Webster Detention Center in Augusta, Georgia, are accused of setting fires in their cells using a pillowcase and a jumpsuit. The fires activated the facility's fire suppression system, which flooded the cell block. Guards responding to the incident put out the fires with a wet blanket. Jail authorities and local media did not explain the detainees' motivations for acting, but did report that the protest came one day after media and Richmond County commissioners toured the overcrowded and decaying facility.
two detainees at the St. Louis City Justice Center in Missouri attacked a guard, stealing his pepper spray and arming themselves with a broomstick. The pair were pepper sprayed by another guard who responded, according to local media. The attack comes just 2 months after a similar attack at the same facility in which detainees were able to free 40 to 50 others from their cells and take control of the cell block.
On Monday, October 16th, at around 3 a.m. in the morning, four prisoners escaped from the Bibb County Detention Center in Macon, Georgia. Allegedly, the prisoners escaped through a broken day room window and a cut fence. The facility was understaffed that evening. One prisoner was recaptured on October 26th in Montezuma. Another prisoner was recaptured on November 3rd in Atlanta, Georgia. As of Sunday, November 5th, the other two prisoners have yet to be captured.
A letter announcing a hunger strike due to dire conditions, dated October 18th, was released from a group of prisoners held in solitary confinement, or the Secure Adjustment Unit, at the Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center in Lancaster, Massachusetts. Advocates have said that 19 prisoners were involved in the hunger strike who were protesting limited out-of-cell time and restrictions on their activities. It's unclear when the hunger strike officially started, but the Department of Corrections acknowledged the strike and that the prisoners refused medical and mental health assessments. The department also said the prisoners were now accepting meals. Prison advocates have said that those involved in the strike were previously held at MCI Cedar Junction, which closed in June of 2023. At MCI Cedar Junction, there was a lawsuit against the DOC for holding prisoners in restrictive housing for longer periods than allowed under law. The lawsuit was dropped when the facility closed. The advocates at the Boston Law School Civil Rights Clinic said the unit at the Sousa is no better than where the men were held at MCI Cedar Junction and intend to investigate further. On Monday, October 23rd, four prisoners escaped from the Adelphoi Village Sweeney Home, an intensive supervision residential facility for juveniles in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. According to reports, the facility is not locked, so the prisoners simply walked out and fled the area. The following day, October 24th, two of the prisoners were recaptured. Shortly after, the other two prisoners returned to the facility but were transported for medical care because they were injured while allegedly jumping over a fence. Shortly before this escape, on October 18th, a prisoner also escaped from the same facility.
Up next, we have Candle, an anarchist writer who is currently serving a sentence in Oregon.
I'm Sophia Johnson. My pronouns are she, they, but I prefer going by Candle, my nickname. So I'm currently incarcerated at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. It's a women's prison out here in Wilsonville, Oregon. I'm originally from Broward County, Florida. I came to Portland originally to help with the uprising, and a string of arrests arising from initially arrests at the riots resulted in my current 90-month sentence that I'm serving here.
And so you're a writer. Were you writing before you were incarcerated?
So I didn't write much before incarceration. Off and on I'd write, but it was, I mostly made memes. I thought it was more fun to edit memes together than really to write something that I had no real credential. So I felt as if people just wouldn't really read my writing. So I really started writing more. Enough at least to call myself a writer here in prison. So what made me want to start writing initially was for the brief period of time that the Portland ABC was willing to supposedly support me, I had Mongoose Distro out of Brooklyn reach out and offer to publish zines of my writings if I wanted to, and I had initially received some pushback from some of my initial correspondence about sharing my story, like what led to my arrest. And that was actually the first story that I wrote to have Mongoose Distro published, was just the expropriation that inevitably led to my sentence. Mostly I write philosophy now. I'm in the publishing stages of getting out a kind of a loose sequel to Nietzsche's Zarathustra titled Wax. It's fittingly written in parable with some poems interlaced within, but mostly it's just poetic prose. And I'm in the final stages of writing a metaphysical critique of reality, centering on the idea of power and life as an aesthetic creation. It's titled The Anti-Fascist, and I hope to finish it later this year. My wax will probably be published sometime this year by Little Black Cart.
I know a lot of people have found you from squatting as an illegalist anarchist. I feel like maybe that's one of the more circulated texts.
Yeah, it actually, from what I can discern at least, most of the people that write me tend to mention squatting as an illegalist anarchist. I've had a couple of instances where people reach out to me after reading my On Governments and Borders, but largely I think there's kind of a lack of first-person narratives of like the insurrectionist anarchist just living, just existing nihilistically, which I don't know. People really seem to just like the story.
And what is your affinity with Luigi Galleani?
I originally read Galleani's The End of Anarchy in, I want to say, 2020. And I fell in love with it. I loved how he talked about individualism being compatible with like the collectivism of his time, which I sometimes like to, I guess, draw parallels with more communal struggle in the day-to-day. I guess my affiliation with Galleani is just like, I like his writing. I like that he was a man of action. And I like his rhetoric. I like how he says things like it's always time to act, and that like we possess like immense potential. Almost, we're like a lion that is just waking, or something to that effect. Like initially, you know, we're a bit groggy, but inevitably, like we're pretty ferocious in our actions and defying the state.
Do you feel like your writing taking form in prison is on that line of thinking? Like this, you know, I know you kind of have a idea that there is a certain standard to uphold about being an anarchist in prison. Does writing function in a specific way towards like a revolutionary goal, or the way that you connect with others both inside and outside? I mean, I'm wondering a bit yeah, how it's functioning for you.
So for me, writing serves, I guess, the end of allowing me to continue engaging in discourse. At this point, the stakes are somewhat high if I resort to any sort of action. I'm probably looking at a life sentence for my next conviction. So writing is kind of just how I can strike this balance between contributing to what I see as the furthering of anarchist theory and I guess just like avoiding the wrath of the state. It keeps my mind sharp, and most of what I'm doing in here is kind of working on my intellectual growth, because it's really the only thing that you can do out of a cell effectively, in my opinion.
Are you able to share your work with anyone that you are locked up with right now?
Like, whenever I get a chance, whenever I just get the vibe, whenever someone tells me, like, oh, I loved the Black Lives Matter riots, or just I love Black Lives Matter, or I love anarchy, something to that effect, I'll share my writing. And I get pretty favorable takes on it. I've actually had women kiss my zines that I share, multiple of my zines even. Someone actually kissed every page of my Squatting as an Illegalist Anarchist, which I didn't necessarily know how to take it, other than, I guess, to feel flattered. But there are some, I guess, negative results also. I've had officers interview me about supposedly starting some sort of gang just for sharing my writing. So, I mean, the only way they would have known that I'd have even shared my zines is through inmate reporting. So I guess that's a thing that also happens. But I share my writings when I can. And when people send in zines, normally after I read them, I'll either put them on our bookshelf or pass them off to someone who I know it's an affinity of theirs, such as like Ecology. I have someone who I normally hand off zines to. Anything occult or magic oriented, I have a couple of people that are really into that stuff, so I'll normally pass off zines to them too. That's essentially what sharing literature is like in here. Like just about anything, and prison doesn't want you to do it, and you kind of have to look out for rats.
And you are studying currently, right, through the University of Oregon?
Yeah, so I'm taking classes through the U of O and Portland State. So currently they only offer a liberal arts degree path, and probably for the foreseeable future they will. I learned yesterday that the Department of Corrections actually like handpicks and approves certain classes. So we've kind of had a lack of math courses, science courses, and it's mostly history, sociology. We've had an anthropology class. I actually had an interesting discussion yesterday. I don't know if it's really going to come to fruition, but Portland State actually really wants to take me on as a math instructor here, just due to, I guess, the issue probably in getting math graduate students, let alone professors, to volunteer to teach in a prison. Yeah, I'm really intrigued by math. I think math ties in really well with philosophy. It's one of the few ways to observe truths from our phenomenal reality.
Speaking a bit about the possibility of teaching or doing your writing, what else do you find that you are taking up in, you know, your project of life in these circumstances?
Well, I've been trying to develop some sort of sense of communal struggle amongst the prisoners that there's kind of been this culture that's been in the prison since anyone I speak to really can remember, where no one's really united really against the cops. They're more aiming for like horizontal violence instead of directing any sort of that like anger, frustration upwards. And it can be damaging. It can hurt these women's emotions. It leads to political arguments that are never good in my interpersonal life. And it's just, it's a lot to deal with. And I've been trying to gradually kind of shift the paradigm towards, like, these cops aren't your friends. They work for the institution that deprives you of life and liberty. But it's difficult. People in here don't trust you, and they're really standoffish. So even overcoming that's really difficult.
You said that you have a book coming out. Has a lot of the writing and publishing side of things, that's, you know, has been like a process of your support team, right?
Yeah, so I can't type in here. So one little black cart needed a typed manuscript. That was basically all the work of Mongoose Distro. He typed it all up for me. I would write it, and I have like a composition notebook in here that I basically write in all the time. So I would hand copy it, so I'd have an original copy, just in case the mailroom loses my mail, which has happened a couple of times. But so Matt gets my hand copied transcription or whatever, my hand copied manuscript, and transcribes it. And that's been how I've even got Little Black Heart to look at it, let alone communicating with them. I've had no luck communicating with them through the mail, so it's all been through either Mongoose Distro or... Yeah, I think it's basically just been him. He's basically helped me publish the whole book.
So it sounds like a lot of your time is spent studying, writing, working on these projects. But I also know that since you were arrested, you have had quite, long-term struggles for advocating for healthcare, both for like a possible traumatic brain injury and ongoing from there. Do you want to speak a bit to your access to healthcare and things like this?
Yeah, so when I was arrested on, it wasn't my June 8th arrest, it was one of the prior arrests at the squat. My arresting peace officer put me in the George Floyd chokehold while I was already in cuffs, while I was basically just getting ready to get booked. Get thrown in the car, rather. It's kind of out of nowhere, but it scraped off part of my head, right at the back of your head where, your spine meets your cerebellum. So I was very concerned. It was an open wound for, 5 or 6 months. Like, it just never healed. And I was unable to get any health care for it. Initially, when I got sent, booked, when they set my bail high and I couldn't get out anymore of jail, they were refusing me health care because it was kind of well known amongst the sheriffs at the jail who I was, why I was there, and I was very, very hated. From what my attorneys tell me, obviously they have a bit of a bigger perspective on the jail. I was hated more than their clients who were child pedophiles or child rapists or murderers. It was just really disproportionate hatred for me. So I would show my head wound to the medical staff at the jail after probably a week or something of trying to get their attention, trying to get them to take it seriously, because it was an open wound and I'm sitting in solitary confinement, because that was the jail's policy for trans people. It was to place them indeterminately in solitary. And that I've had, I'd say maybe two medical staff from the jail that had looked at it. One of them laughed in my face and didn't say anything. They just moved on. And the other just told me to my face that they couldn't do anything about it, which now I know is incorrect. But I was just starting to deal with, the justice system in an overt fashion. So I didn't necessarily know my legal rights, and my attorneys weren't super helpful because they're criminal attorneys. It's outside of their area of expertise, but I just didn't really have anything. So fast forward to prison, because the whole time I couldn't get treatment for this wound. It's now infected, probably, 9 months into my sentence. I still haven't been able to get anyone to look at it seriously. I've had 2-ish, maybe 3 appointments where they've taken a look at it, but they've just told me, they can't do anything. It's healing. Again, contemptuous sort of perspective on my head wound. I had one of the nurse practitioners here laugh in my face when I showed them it, because they asked how I got it, and, you know, I told the story, and they just pretty much find it humorous for some reason, but eventually I got, like, antibiotic ointment to put on it for the infection, so I have some hair there now. It's kind of healed over. I have, like, a pretty big, like, elliptical scar now, like, right under that, like, little abrasion that we have on, like, the back of our head. It's just kind of forever there now, I guess. Kind of sucks, but eventually I got, like, antibiotic ointment that you can buy over the counter after, like a year, year and a half. It's really difficult to navigate the healthcare system here.
Would you like to speak a bit about, like, medical care around transitioning?
So I've been on my hormones in custody since, I want to say, late February of last year. There was roughly like a month and a half period where the facility was denying me my hormones, despite the fact that I've been transitioning on via hormones for, I think, 4 years before I came to jail or prison. My jail that I was in did a similar thing where I went around like a month and a half without hormones. But I currently get hormones. They actually check my hormone levels pretty consistently because I've had attorneys kind of threaten the facility. And I've literally just gotten to the point where I'll quote case law from my own legal study to medical staff rather than trying to speak to them in more layman terms because they just are going to ignore you. So I've been trying to get gender-affirming surgery for the entirety of my time in prison. I learned when I came to prison through my attorneys that prisons actually have to provide gender-affirming surgeries. They're medically necessary, and later I learned from my own legal study that the medical care in prison has to be commensurate with medical care that you would receive while free, and further, that medical decisions can only be formed via medical consensus, so they can't be influenced by economic sway or political sway, e.g., like, they can't say they hate trans people, so they're not going to provide trans surgeries. They can't say the surgery's too expensive, so they won't provide it. So I'm kind of in this struggle where the facility is saying that they're going to give me my surgery. I just recently got my second letter of approval for the surgery, not even 2 days ago, wherein it's approved by a second therapist and whatnot. So I'm supposed to consult with a surgeon sometime soon, but the fact of the matter is that no one at this facility has yet received any feminizing gender-affirming surgery. So it's kind of hard to believe that it'll ever happen when some of these women in here have been trying to get their gender-affirming surgeries for, I want to say, 7-8 years. And the prisons just keep moving the goalposts. I'm kind of struggling. I just recently had a lawsuit accepted against the facility, so I'm in my first lawsuit against the prison, and it relates to what amounts to a de facto ban on vaginoplasty. And since this facility utilizes a bottom-up procedure where they perform vaginoplasty before they get to mammoplasty or facial feminization or anything thereof, or therein, rather, it just means there's essentially a blanket ban on any other procedure. Even though I've met medical criteria, even though it's been deemed medically necessary, the facility is refusing to allow me to get these procedures, which I wouldn't even have to pay for because my insurance covers it. So they've kind of put my whole transition on pause, and they are doing the same thing to every other trans woman here, so I just took it to the courts. I guess, speak to the DOC's current excuses, if that's desired. Because they can't outright say that they're not going to deny the procedure. So they've kind of gotten a bit clever. At first, they said that they couldn't take anyone outside of the facility for procedures due to COVID. And that put everyone's gender-affirming care on the back burner for like 2 years while the facility handled COVID. Currently, they're just claiming there's a huge wait list, which, yeah, like there's kind of a long wait list for vaginoplasty, but if you've been waiting for like 6 or 7 years, like you should just be at the top of the wait list. It's not like you're going to suffer less without the procedure.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Sleepy King starts now.